All around the world, elders have passed down dark folkloric stories filled with horrors and laced with dread. These tales are, more often than not, somehow connected to the real world in one way or another, frequently spread as a warning of things that the people of the time would need to be aware of. Storytelling as a way of sharing information has been part of our species since the beginning of human intelligence, with cave paintings dating significantly farther back than any written word. Even today, we will use mythical beings to ensure our children behave. Some of these stories involve shadowy figures. Some involve jolly bearded men. And some, like this one, involve horrifying human-like entities that blur between the world of spirits and monsters. A being that's so horrifying that to many American Indians, it is better not even to discuss it. The incarnation of winter, the embodiment of hunger, and the personification of selfishness. My name is Luke Mordew, and this urban legend is Wendigo. Cannibalism, in its bluntest terms, is the act of consuming the flesh of another belonging to the same species, and has been recorded in over 1,500 species worldwide. The word itself is derived from the Spanish canibal or caribel, used initially as a name for the Caribs, people from the West Indies who had been said to eat human flesh. It is something we have seen several times throughout the animal kingdom, but is most commonly found in aquatic settings, particularly amongst fish. Cannibalism in all aspects is often due to areas where nutrients are scarce, forcing the survivors to turn to others as a food source. However, no matter the species, a consistent theme seems to be that cannibalism, whilst benefiting the individual, has a detrimental effect on the whole population, in turn enforcing the notion that it is, by its very nature, an incredibly selfish act. That is not the only complication that comes with the act of cannibalism, as some studies suggest that the risk of encountering parasitic infected victims grows significantly in areas with a higher rate of cannibalism. However, it is unlikely that any disease has evolved to spread solely through this act. Amongst some tribes in Papua New Guinea, where consuming the brains of the dead was part of funeral rituals, a disease named kuru had spread amongst them. This is a cerebellar dysfunctional disease that is known to degenerate the brain, causing a decrease in motor activity control and more. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy, also known as mad cow disease, is a prion disease often associated with feeding contaminated bovine tissue to cattle. This is a dangerous neurodegenerative disease and is possible to be spread to human beings if one were to consume the contaminated beef. Several ailments can come from the act of cannibalistic feasting. Amongst human beings, it is almost universally accepted to be a heinous act, left only as a last resort for those fighting to survive in the bleakest of situations. But what if you were to do so anyway? What could such a horrifying act do to a person's psyche? And just what darkness could this consumption attract? In my telling of an encounter with the Wendigo, we will follow Chaska, Paul, and Shawnee, three men out in the cold wilderness during a Canadian winter. The wind howled through the treetops, causing the decrepit branches to swirl in a circular formation above. Although covered in mud, The ground was hard and bumpy from the ice-cold air, as if every aspect of this wilderness had turned to stone. Snow had fallen heavily throughout the day. However, the swaying trees had worked as a natural umbrella over the area, leaving nothing but patches of white against the frozen earth. Now, the sun had fallen, and the air had swiftly grown colder, allowing a trace of bitterness to sneak through the forest in the shadow of the night. Jaska, Paul, and Shawnee sat close by, but away from each other, as they clambered hold of any warmth that they could, their faces glowing in the dimming light of the fire between them. This is where they would sleep, taking turns to wake up and ensure that the flames remained crackling. It was now Sunday night, and although none had said it out loud, they were all filled with fear. They had arrived as a four the previous morning, prepared for a trek in the wilderness and overnight stay, only to return home the following evening. Right now, they should be back in their respective homes with their wives, their stomachs filled with hot food and their skin clean and warm. Instead, they were fighting the anxious thoughts that questioned whether they would freeze to death in their sleep. Shawnee and James had gotten into an argument that morning, causing James to act uncharacteristically aggressively towards them all. He hadn't slept well the night before, complaining of horrifying nightmares that kept him up, which had made him more irritable than he would usually be. However, when the group explained this to him, he took it as a dismissal of what he was saying, and in anger, he walked off into the trees, taking with him the only working power pack that they had. The trek was ruined for the group. Instead of venturing through the set paths they had decided on, they had begun delving into the woodland in search of James, and over time, each of their phones would die. They hadn't brought much power or clothes and had little to no food between them. This was supposed to be a one-weekend trip, with one overnight campout, so they had only packed lightly. Unfortunately, by the time they had already realized that James was nowhere to be found, they had lost their way and had now spent the latter half of their evening wandering through the wilderness, hoping to see something they recognized as civilization. Our ancestors used to hunt out here, and we've got lost within hours without our phones, Jaska suddenly blurted out while staring into the flames, the cheeky glint in his eye still evident for the others to see. They all chuckled as Paul laid back on the ground to look up at the treetops that seemed to dance in the blending of the wind and shadow. Shawnee suddenly jumped to his feet, stretching his arms out with a deep sigh as he stepped further into the shadow of the trees, announcing that he needed to go for a piss. He stepped over the roots and clambered past the shrubbery until he was out of sight of the flames and embers. He checked back, ensuring that the others were not looking, before reaching into his pocket and pulling out a half-eaten protein bar he had kept hidden away. None of them had eaten much since the morning, indulging themselves the night before so that they had less to carry. But what the others didn't know was that Shawnee, who was into his fitness, always had a protein bar nearby. This was his, and he didn't know how long they were going to be out here, so he kept it from them, giving himself an inch of it every few hours of the day. He threw it into his mouth and hastily chewed while simultaneously shoving the remainder back into his pocket, his eyes fixated on the fireplace where Jaska and Paul remained. He swallowed it fast before hunting for the crumbs in his mouth with his tongue, ensuring that there were no telltale signs of what he'd been doing. But amongst the silence of this hidden snack, a slight hiss began to fill the air. He paused what he was doing and turned back into the shadow of the trees, listening out for whatever could be making that noise. But before any thoughts could even enter his mind, a harrowing, blood-curdling shriek bellowed from the distance, echoing from the dark. Jaska and Paul instantly shot up alert at the sound as Shawnee dived into the light of the fire to join them, terrified to be alone in the dark. None said a word to each other, all listening for more signs of what this noise could have been. Up ahead, trees were creaking, with branches twisting and snapping, letting out natural clicks and groans that emanated into the night, as if something significant and agile was climbing from branch to branch. And then suddenly, silence. The men wouldn't sleep well that night. Now, not only because they feared the cold would get them in their sleep, but also because they were afraid whatever was in the distance would find itself amongst them. They couldn't risk putting out the fire, though. And secretly, none of them wanted to be dropped into the dark after hearing those horrible sounds. The next day, their bags were repacked and they were on their way once again. The ground was covered in a display of brown, bronze, and gold leaves that had now been coated in chunks of white snow around the white trees that displayed brightly against the earth. The noises hadn't returned the night before, which all could confirm as none had slept for long, being on high alert to every bird or bat that flapped its wings above. Today, though, the fear had dampened, now completely engulfed by the dread they all felt deep in their stomachs with every step they took, only seeing more woodland ahead. Each had grown tired, dehydrated and hungry, and talking had waned to a minimum. That was, until Chaska decided they should play I Spy to pass the time. The other two grumbled at the idea, but deep down, they also needed a distraction to keep them moving forward. And so they obliged. In an attempt to be funny, Paul would always choose tea when it was his go, with the result consistently being tree. It was funny the first time, but quickly lost its appeal amongst the group. By round four, the enthusiasm for this game had rapidly dwindled, but Chaska forged on, scanning the area with that glint in his eye slowly dimming. I spy with my little eye, he announced, still contemplating what he should choose. But very suddenly, he stopped in his tracks, his eyes fixated on the white trees to their left. His whole body slowly turned to face it, and his eyes filled with tears as the glint finally went out, now replaced with overwhelming fear. Shawnee and Paul stopped with him, instantly hit with a nervous disposition at seeing the horror on his face. Paul turned to follow Chaska's eyeline to witness what he could see, but his curiosity was instantly morphed into the same horrified expression as his mouth gently opened to whimper. What is that? Shawnee turned to look out with them, terrified by what it could have been that they could see as he studied the white barks of the trees that shot out of the golden floor below. He could not see what they could see, and the fear that hung in the air seemed to remove any ability or vocalization from his dry throat. But then, as his eyes focused once more, he finally saw it. Between the trees up ahead was what looked to be another slightly darker tree. But this was moving. It was a very tall, extremely skinny figure, as if a man had been stretched and starved for weeks. Its skin was pale, and its eyes were so sunken that from back here, its face looked skeletal and dead. Shawnee opened his mouth to force out speech, hoping that one of the others had focused better and found it to be nothing but a strangely shaped tree. But before this could even occur, the creature had already begun to step forward at an alarming rate. Without hesitation, Paul and Chaska darted into the direction they were already heading, desperate to escape its sight. In return, the charging being gripped hold of one of the trees and flung itself from it, clambering from branch to branch as it swooped into their direction. Shawnee had no choice but to take this opportunity for himself, darting in the opposite direction of the creature, unaware that a steep slope was just beyond. He jumped over a root that stuck out of the ground and took his first step over the hill, trying to keep his balance as he made his way down, rustling through the orange. Still, with the combination of wet leaves and icy floors, he had quickly lost his bearings, slipping and stumbling down them before slamming against the hard, frozen earth below. He lay there for a moment, winded and in great pain. But this was short-lived, as he knew he had to keep moving. He forced his body upright and pushed himself against a large tree he had luckily missed on the way down. He was too afraid to even look up the slope, terrified at what he may find. So instead, he listened carefully for any sounds that he may hear. But there was nothing. Just the gentle breeze of the Monday morning air gently caressing the treetops. He sighed and slowly turned his head, peeking around the tree's bark. Luckily, there was nothing except an owl sitting amongst a branch, its eyes scanning the area relaxedly. This was a good sign, as nothing had seemingly scared it away. But this moment of relief did not last for long, as a small thud beside him caused him to jump in fright. He turned, ready to charge away from the entity, but nothing could be seen. It sounded as if a chestnut had fallen to the ground, hitting the floor next to him. Although, he had to be sure. So he felt around the ground to feel for it, grabbing it between his fingers and lifting it to his face to study. There, gripped in his trembling cold hand, was a gold ring covered in dirt and muck. A shiver shot down his spine as he studied, his mind filled with a horrified fog that misted over any clarity in his thoughts. He knew what this was. It was James's wedding ring. Shawnee clenched it tightly in his hand, knowing full well that there was nowhere to run, as he lifted his chin to look directly above his head. As expected, he was now face to face with the long, pale, skinny entity that was now silently and slowly climbing down the bark of the tree head first, its blackened, sunken eyes fixated on his, whilst its sharp teeth snarled through the decaying wounds of what were once lips. Paul and Chaska were far away, now able to hear the sounds of cars in the distance. They were so close to finally getting out, yet they had frozen on the spot. Both of them desperately wanted to get out of these woods. Both had wanted to get away from whatever that horrifying sight was. However, they were conflicted. As far as they knew, Shawnee was still alive out there. Could they really leave without finding him first? They had to try at least. They knew that. They had to look out for each other. No matter what, they were in this together, and unlike James and Shawnee, there was no way that either would ever be so selfish. The story of the Wendigo first belongs to the Algonquin tribes that spread across the northeastern parts of the USA and Canada, including Ojibwe, Delaware, Cree, Arapaho, Cheyenne, Illinois, Kickapoo, Bow, and more. However, the name of this being varies from tribe to tribe. The Ojibwe know it as the similarly titled Winteco or Windigo, whereas the Cree refer to them as Witteco or Witticow. With how far the legend has spread, it had over time taken on slightly different names, pronunciations and spellings, with the being also being known as Wendigo, Weetigo, Windigook, Weetigo and Witteca, whilst other names that vary a little more are also used to describe it, such as Achen, Chenu and Kiwok. Even with this long list of names, there are still several more, with more than 37 words used to describe this one thing. It is not only the name of the Windigo that has many iterations, but also many characteristics, mostly due to the fact that its stories were shared orally amongst its people, giving room for change. Within the Cree, there are known to be two specific types of Windigo. One is the supernatural cannibalistic entity that holds great power, and the other is a human form, where a person develops cannibalistic cravings while slowly morphing into a fully fledged Windigo. According to the early legends, a Windigo would be created whenever a human being would resort to cannibalism, likely referring to the times when American Indians and settlers would find themselves stranded in the bitter cold of snow and ice of the North Woods. Other iterations suggest that a person does not need to commit the act of cannibalism to be taken over by the Windigo, and can instead become possessed due to displaying extreme greed, gluttony, and excess. To the Cree people, the Windigo is a symbolic figure. It represents the failure of social relations when the symbiotic relationship between a person and the larger group becomes unbalanced, with the transformation representing a change from a human being to a greedy, cannibalistic presence. To make matters worse, it is said that once turned, the Windigo will first hunt the people closest to it, with many accounts from several Algonquin groups suggesting that the Windigo first went after their own families, fixated on children. In many American Indian beliefs, the Windigo will still resemble the human being it used to be, with only small features giving it away that they are now only a vessel, much like how possessions are depicted in modern media. The reported actions and appearances of a Wendigo vary from culture to culture, but the basics have remained consistent throughout them all. It is known as an American Indian spirit inside of what was once a human being, although, due to specific factors, they had transformed. The transformation itself is not sudden, but a gradual one, with the person afflicted by it said to grow more violent and selfish as time goes on. Once manifested, the Windigo is stated to be responsible for environmental and cultural stresses amongst the American Indian believers. This includes isolation and starvation during harsh winters. The way it looks in its original tellings is consistent across the board, known as being worn to the point of emaciation, with its thinning skin pulled tightly over its protruding bones. It is described as having a deathly complexion in a grey or yellowish tone, with its eyes sucked deep into their sockets, creating a skeletal-like figure. At times, they are even described as being covered in matted hair. On top of this, it is also said that its lips are ripped apart and tattered, as if the entity's hunger had grown so intense that it had begun to chew at its own mouth. It is often described as emitting a strange odor of decay and decomposition, further representing signs of death and corruption. They also say it would bring with it extreme cold, which can be easily attributed to the fact that all the communities who shared the myth of the Wendigo lived in areas that often experienced long, bitter winters. This enforced the legend as a reminder that to survive, you would need to work as a team. Some tribes in the area share stories of Wendigo being giant, at around 10 feet tall. Its size grew in proportion to each person it ate, so it could never be full. However, this is not a characteristic seen amongst all Algonquin cultures. In many ways, the Wendigo is said to torment the local communities with this, being very much a force of evil, with its shrieks heard over the winds of winter and its shadow found lurking amongst the darkness of the trees. However, there is a positive aspect to the Wendigo, as its presence reminds the people of what happens when we put our selfish desires before others, enforcing the importance of sticking together as a community and looking out for one another. It is also commonly said that along with its strange features and cannibalistic desires, it has a heart encased in ice, making it a cold and uncomfortable existence, which is perhaps why they are often said to appear more frequently in winter. On top of this, it is said to be in a constant state of hunger, stuck in a state of continuous selfish desires, devoid of impulse control and lacking resources, revealing the imbalance between two souls inhabiting one body. To cure or kill the Wendigo spirit, you must somehow melt the ice that encases their heart. And by destroying this icy heart, you would not only kill the Wendigo, but would also allow the spirit of the person it once was to be finally free. According to Cree lore, if you are in the process of changing and are still yet to consume human flesh, which would finalize the possession, then there is still a chance for you to stop the transition. You will need to eat fatty animal meats or grease, which will cause your body to eject the spirit by vomiting ice. The Cree, the Ojibwe, and the Assiniboine were also known to perform a ceremonial dance during times of famine to help ward off these evil spirits. However, this was also performed at the Sundance, a ceremony offering prayers for the welfare of the people and for the increase in their resources. In some legends, it has been said that the Wendigo can integrate into society, suggesting that they, at times, can speak, often taunting or threatening their intended victims. Some say that on the occasions a Wendigo has managed to infiltrate a community, their mere presence can be infectious, with a sense of evil and dread permeating the minds of its people, potentially even causing a transition in them too. Over the years, stories of Wendigo have appeared in several forms of fiction outside of Indigenous American literature, with settlers gripped by its lore. The first time it appeared in non-Indigenous literature was in Algernon Blackwood's 1910 novella titled The Wendigo. However, here, not only had Algernon borrowed a part of the American Indians' folklore, but he had also morphed it against them. In his iteration, the Wendigo itself had become more of a descriptive template for the Indian savage stereotype that was so prevalent at the time. It would seem that Blackwood's defiled version of this legend would be the basis for many future iterations in mainstream horror. In 1933, August Deleth wrote The Thing That Walked on the Wind, and in 1941, he wrote Ithaqua, blending the creature into H.P. Lovecraft's Tales of Cthulhu. In 1973, the Wendigo first appeared in Marvel Comics, used as a rival to the Incredible Hulk in issue 162. This iteration was conjured by Steve Englehart and Herb Trimpey, with Englehart saying, "I knew about the legend of the Wendigo and thought, between his strength and sad story, that he sounded like a good Hulk opponent. And although not a familiar foe, this monster has appeared in several Marvel comics over the years." Blackwood's first non-native telling of Wendigo would be retold in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark in 1981, and would be the one to inspire its iteration in Stephen King's famous novel, Pet Sematary, in 1983. In King's story, it is a personification of evil, described as having antlers in place of ears, yellow-grey eyes, and a pointed yellow tongue. This description of the Wendigo's appearance would stick out in readers' minds as both fascinating and horrifying, resulting in the longevity of its iteration. Now, when many worldwide imagine the Wendigo, it is this antlered creature that they think of. This, in itself, is a fascinating subject to get into. As a writer myself, albeit nowhere near the caliber of Stephen King, I could see that he was using the real-life lore of the Earth that he had been raised upon. It is not uncommon for storytellers to make a legend their own, changing aspects to fit their story. King's version of the Wendigo is not entirely disconnected from its original roots, but that being said, it also strips it of much of its ideas and purpose. The story of Pet Sematary is both about the natural and unnatural merging, and so the imagery of an entity seemingly so connected to both makes perfect sense. Although, it is worth noting that the Wendigo had no relation to deer amongst any of the American Indians' tales. However, it did at times have strong connections to owls. Due to the undeniably fascinating imagery of an antlered creature, people who previously did not know of the Wendigo would find this version stuck in their minds. It is an image they wanted to draw, paint, and remake, eventually becoming the official imagery of many non-native people. That being said, it is also perfectly understandable that for the indigenous people, it is a mark of sheer disrespect. Not only did our white ancestors take most of their land with brute force, resulting in the native people becoming minorities in their own country, but now their descendants were plucking out their folklore, stories, and beliefs, and bastardizing them to become cryptids and mythical monsters. It is undeniable that in exchange for memorable imagery, we also lost much of the nuance behind their stories, with much of it still relevant even today. With this in mind, the use of the Wendigo is never far, with its screen credits including Charmed, Sleepy Hollow, Blood Ties, Teen Wolf, Supernatural, Grimm, Hannibal, and even My Little Pony. It has appeared in several novels, video games, plays, and movies, most recently appearing in the film Antlers, directed by Scott Cooper and produced by Guillermo del Toro. But even here, with a film directly about the Wendigo, the American Indians are side characters, with their folklore being a mystery to uncover. Brady DeSanti, a professor of religious studies at the University of Nebraska, has been quoted as saying, "I think audiences and filmmakers alike occasionally get tired of the same old, tried and true monsters of the big screen and look outside a Western context for inspiration. More often than not, the filmmakers simply take the Wendigo and make it into a relatable monster for Western audiences, defeating the purpose of going outside of a Western context for inspiration in the first place." With the removal of this greater context, the Wendigo has changed over the years from a nuanced, fascinating, horrible warning to those who may be straying too close to selfish living. It has become another monster in our Western Rolodex of horrors, becoming more marketable. This has salt in the wound to many American Indian scholars who have written about the subject, as the lands that were once theirs and theirs alone were now engulfed by a profit-based society, with the very existence of billionaires going against all that these Wendigo tales were saying. Human stories worldwide are shared between continents, cultures, and countries, and it is normal for those stories to morph into something more accessible for the people it is being told to. However, It would be insincere not to step back and see the nuance of the bigger picture at play here. It is perfectly understandable for American Indians to feel frustrated that this story had been borrowed from them, only to be repackaged and sold for financial gain. Especially when the legends of Wendigo are so heavily entwined with the notions of greed and selfishness. It is also worth noting that in a large amount of Western media where the Wendigo is used, there is a notable lack of actual American Indians in these stories. When they are present, it is almost always nothing but a side character, albeit one with a deeper understanding of the mystical. The Wendigo story will remain part of our world's folklore for years, with its survival proving its relevance. I have no issue with stories being shared and adapted from different places worldwide, but we must respect their origins and bear in mind the more significant context of what they represent, as a legend and as a story. The Wendigo is something to fear, whether in literal monstrous form or symbolic. It is an essential reminder of how important it is to look out for others and ourselves, but it is also a reminder to be vigilant about the intentions of those around us. The Wendigo comes for us in many ways, and not all of them involve physical force. Over the years, several stories have been shared of a strange disease that is said to come over those being hunted by the Wendigo spirit. This condition has become to be known popularly as Wendigo fever, with its presence being a critical sign that you have been chosen as its next meal. It is said to begin with the presence of a disturbing odor that only the infected individual can smell. Once asleep, this person will find themselves plagued with nightmares so intense that they'll struggle to sleep for long. However, once they are awake, it is said that they will feel a horrifying burning sensation in their legs and feet. This would be so intense that it would cause them to have no choice but to run from their homes, shedding their clothes as they do. The idea behind this is to lure the victim away from safety and into the woods, where the Wendigo is waiting. This is just another element of the Wendigo lore. Wendigo fever is not the only apparent psychological phenomenon said to connect to this legend. Over time, in our very real world, the Wendigo has been mentioned in medical fields, where an evident psychological break in a subject's psyche results in an individual craving no food other than human flesh. I hope you're enjoying this chapter so far, and we will return to it. But first, I wanted to steal you away for a moment. I love what I do, and delving into the history of urban legends and folklore is as fascinating as it is rewarding. I feel fortunate to have thousands of people listening to my research each week. The kind messages I receive are both heartwarming and reassuring. However, it takes a very long time to create each chapter. And no matter how much I enjoy it, doing this for free is not always a possibility, leading to significant gaps between seasons, gaps that I hope to shorten in the future. And this is where your support is needed. Through Patreon, you can subscribe for as little as £3 a month, less than a latte at your local barista. By doing so, you will receive all episodes without any advertisements or breaks. You will also be able to listen to each chapter the Friday before the general public. On top of this, you'll receive a weekly newsletter and discounts on merchandise. We're not just building a community there, but forging a fellowship of folklore enthusiasts. Join our private group chats, where you can share your stories, theories, and discoveries with like-minded individuals captivated by modern myths. Let's discover what you've heard, what you may want to hear, or what you think of any specific legend. Your support on Patreon isn't just a subscription. It's an investment in preserving our urban legend show. Please help us continue our journey and in return, become part of our team. Not only that, but if you join us today, you'll be entered into a prize draw where I'll be choosing 8 patron names at random before the next season begins. Once contacted, if permission is granted, you will be written into one of our new stories, putting you within the legends we tell. Visit our Patreon page by following the link in our show notes, clicking subscribe, and paying whatever you can afford to give. I look forward to your support as we continue to unravel folklore together. And now, back to the legend. Throughout time, there have been several anthropological texts referring to a culture-bound psychiatric phenomenon best known as Wendigo psychosis. This is said to be a condition described as having intense cravings for human flesh and an intense fear of becoming a cannibal. This psychosis has been characterized as involving paranoia, anxiety, hallucinations, and cannibalistic urges, which have often come to fruition through a fusion of cultural narratives and psychological vulnerabilities. It has been said that if the individual living with Wendigo psychosis were ever to taste human flesh, they would, from then onwards, be unable to eat any other food, with stories claiming that they could even go as far as to believe that they indeed were an invincible man-eating monster. This was not just an issue that resided only amongst the American Indian tribes who shared stories of the Wendigo, but was something that was taken quite seriously by those in psychiatric fields across North America. It was in 1993 that the International Statistical Classifications of Diseases and Related Health Problems classified Wendigo as a culture-specific disorder, describing it as a rare historical account of cannibalistic obsession, with symptoms including depression, homicidal or suicidal thoughts, and a compulsion to eat human flesh. It was as far back as the 1970s that the legitimacy of Wendigo psychosis was brought into question, and it was during this scrutiny that it was found that not a single subject had been studied. A growing number of people had begun to suspect that these cases could merely be a product of hostile accusations made to justify a victim's murder. And now, it is seemingly widely understood to be a pseudo-scientific notion. Many researchers have argued that this Wendigo psychosis phenomenon was nothing more than an idea pieced together by naive anthropologists who took the story shared amongst the indigenous people at face value. That being said, many still feel it truly is a historical phenomenon due to the number of eyewitness accounts, not just of the Algonquin people, but also of others. And with that in mind, let's delve into the stories behind some of these reported cases. The winter of 1878 was an icy one in Canada, with strong winds and heavy snow. During this time, in what would later be named Central Alberta, was a Cree man who went by the name of Swift Runner, or Kaki Si Kuchin, who lived with his wife and children. His younger years were considered nothing out of the ordinary, receiving a solid Cree education with the other children of the area. He was known to be skilled with a bow and arrow from a young age and had gone on to trade with the Hudson's Bay Company later in life. In 1875, he even served as a guide for the Northwest Mounted Police. That being said, he had grown extremely fond of whiskey, which had been smuggled into the area disguised as medicine. It had even been noted that he was an ugly customer to meet when on a spree, so much so that some even referred to him as the terror of the whole region. He had vices and characteristics that were unfavorable to many when drunk. However, in most aspects, he was an average, respected man amongst his peers, with his enormous size and friendly disposition. He was well-liked and considered mild and trustworthy. As a husband, it was said that he was a considerate man, whilst being very fond of his children. However, even with all these facts, suspicions were quickly raised when he returned from his winter camp in the spring of 1879, alone. Kaki C. Kuchin would eventually tell the Northwest Mounted Police, who was still a very new authority in the area, that his wife had died of suicide and that his children had died of starvation. However, it was instantly noticed by those that had seen him that he did not look as though he had been underfed in any way. It would be Inspector Sivier Gonya who would be given the task of investigating Kaki C. Kuchin's strange behavior. He gathered up a small party of police officers and ventured out to the winter camp where the family had stayed. Once they had arrived, Kaki C. Kuchin showed them a grave that he had made near the camp, explaining that, unfortunately, his son, who had died during the winter, was buried here. They checked inside this grave and found the bones of a small boy, although how the body had already decomposed so much so fast was curious. However, when the mounted police officers looked a little further at the surrounding areas, they were horrified by what they found. Scattered around the encampment were dozens of human bones. This would lead to the true explanation of what happened, as Kaki C. Kuchin confessed to all he had done during the isolation of the winter months. He would describe several horrifying dreams that plagued his sleep for many nights, with him soon realizing that he was now falling victim to a Wendigo spirit. Over time, this Wendigo would call on him to consume the people around him, with this voice growing louder and more convincing with each passing word, until eventually, Kaki C. Kuchin was no more, and the spirit of the hungry Wendigo had inhabited him. Once he had lost his soul's control over the body, the Wendigo would murder his wife before consuming her. He would later claim that the Wendigo would then go on to force one of his sons to murder his younger brother. Soon after, it would take their youngest and hang them from a lodgepole. Not satisfied with the torment and horrors it had created, it would then murder Kaki Sin Kuchin's brother and finally his mother-in-law, whom he referred to as a bit tough. Soon, they were all dead. Although, whether his first son had died by his hands or not is still up for debate. This story of the Wendigo spirit taking over his body to encourage the slaughter and cannibalism of his family was a strange and horrifying tale to hear for all who heard it. To emphasize just how unnecessary this terrible act was, it is also worth noting that the emergency food supplies were only 25 miles away and within a fair distance of travel if he was so inclined to do so. The trial for these murders began on August 8, 1879. Here, the notion of a Wendigo spirit possessing this man's body was instantly thrown out, with him being seen as nothing more than a murderer and a cannibal. It would not be long before Kaki C. Kuchin was sentenced to hanging, which would have been the first formal execution in Western Canada, taking place on December the 20th, 1879. Shortly after this, in 1897, an Anishinaabe man by the name of Machiquanabe was convicted of manslaughter for shooting and killing his foster father, a man who he believed to be a Wendigo. This account would be one to change history forever, as it was the catalyst that prompted the proposition that Indigenous peoples were bound by colonial law regardless of their religious and cultural beliefs. In 1907, a man by the name of Jack Fidler, or Zawinul Gizigo Gubau, was arrested for the alleged murder of an individual that had been said to be a Wendigo. Over the years, Zawinul had become a famous shaman due to his alleged spiritual abilities, such as the power to conjure animals and protect his people from spells that may have been cast on them. However, the ability he would become most famous for was the power to defeat Wendigo spirits, with him boasting a defeat of 14 Wendigos in his time. It had been claimed that some of the Wendigos had been sent to his people by enemy shamans, whilst others had been members of his band who the spirit had taken in. In some cases, it has also been claimed that family members would ask Zawinul to assist in killing very sick loved ones before they could turn into a Wendigo. Some have even gone so far as to claim that he had been approached by the Wendigo themselves before they had taken over completely. His reputation would eventually spread beyond his group, known as the Sucker People. He would eventually be approached by Cree ministers to ask if he could bring Christianity to his people. However, he refused this request. And by the beginning of the 20th century, the Sucker People were amongst the only indigenous tribes in North America still living traditionally, including little to no government imposition. Finally, in the early months of 1907, two members of the Northwest Mounted Police would arrive in the area to introduce Canadian law to it. And once these officers had caught wind of the many Wendigo slayings, they would arrest Zawinul alongside his brother, who was known to them as Joseph Fidler. The charge that was brought towards the now elderly brothers was that of murder, specifically the killing of Wasakapikwe, who was in fact Joseph's daughter-in-law. This is a strange situation, as I, not believing in spirits, see these events as murder. Yet, there is a blurriness to the situation, as this is very much the story of invaders entering a new land and punishing the indigenous people for not following their newly imposed rules. As the brothers awaited trial, newspapers around the country spread the word of the dramas that had been unfolding, which led to the public's outrage at what they considered devil worship. This had seemingly become too much for Zawinul, who managed to escape captivity during a walk on September the 30th, giving him enough time to take his own life. The brother would still go on trial, with eyewitnesses testifying that Wasakapikwe was in horrifying pain whilst being incurably sick, although it was also stated that, more often than not, the idea of euthanasia was put forward by the brothers themselves. Eventually, Joseph Fidler would be convicted and sentenced to death. Soon after, appeals would be made that would secure his release. However, the order would arrive 3 days after he had died in prison and had never been told. The belief in the Wendigo as a tangible evil spirit may have waned over the years, but the importance of its retelling has remained. There are those out there who do not understand the nuanced elements of the entity, but are drawn to the notions of its existence. Some see it instead as a symbolic manifestation of much that is wrong in today's world. The Wendigo will seemingly live on for years to come, feeding off of our imaginations as we, in turn, use it to better make sense of an ever-growing, confusing world. You would not need to travel too deep into the web to find a string of videos all claiming to have caught sightings of a real-life Wendigo out in the woods. There are countless stories, occasionally alongside blurry images and haunting artwork. You can now even buy soft, cuddly, antlered toy versions of the Wendigo. Over recent years, this antlered version of the Wendigo has crept closer to the world of cryptids, often seen in the same categories of Mothman, Bigfoot, and the Loch Ness Monster. Still, it is essential to remember that Wendigo are not cryptids. They are evil spirits with a rich tapestry of narratives from different indigenous tribes across North America. This story has existed far longer than any of our current cryptids. It is a folkloric-like tale that has been shared for generations, not just as a warning against selfish desires and gluttonous intentions, but also as a reminder to be mindful of the community's values. Whilst the Wendigo spirit has been remolded and remodeled amongst the European settlers' descendants in much of the Western world, to many American Indians, the Wendigo has remained this warning against greed. That's not to say that it hasn't also changed here, evolving to fit modern sensibilities. It is now associated more with the excesses of capitalism and greed, now connected to colonialism rather than barren winters. American Indian scholar Dr. Jack D. Forbes wrote in his 1978 book, Columbus and Other Cannibals, The Wetico Disease of Exploitation, Imperialism and Terrorism, that Wetico is a Cree term, which refers to a cannibal or, more specifically, to an evil person or spirit who terrorizes other creatures by means of terrible evil acts, including cannibalism. I have come to the conclusion that imperialism and exploitation are forms of cannibalism, and in fact, are precisely those forms of cannibalism which are most diabolical or evil. It should be understood that Weticos do not eat other humans only in a symbolic sense. The deaths of tens of millions of Jews, Slavs, etc. at the hands of the Nazis, the deaths of tens of millions of blacks in slavery days, the deaths of up to 30 million or more Indians in the 1500s, the terribly short lifespans of the Mexican Indian farm workers in the US and of American Indians generally today, the high death rates in the early industrial centers amongst factory workers, and so on, all clearly attest to the fact that the wealthy and the exploitative literally consume the lives of those that they exploit. That, I would affirm, is truly and literally cannibalism. And it is cannibalism accompanied by no spiritually meaning ceremony or ritual. Rather than being an antlered cryptid or an American Indian version of a werewolf, Wendigo is once again shown to be a conceptual entity that represents much of humanity's greed and personal hunger. Those in power are still seeking to gain more control. Those with large sums of money are still looking to add to their wealth, accumulating large sums for the sake of owning it. We may not need to warn each other of the horrors that may come with cannibalism anymore, but with so much of Wendigo's story still so relevant today, this is a spirit that will continue to walk amongst the trees for many years to come.
Urban Legends is researched, written, and produced by Luke Mordew. Original score by Billy Jupp, with additional sounds from storyblocks.com. If you like what you heard and want to hear more, click subscribe on your chosen podcast provider and delve into the mysteries of our previous and future chapters. To find more, including merchandise, video content, images, and more, visit urbanlegendsfolklore.com. If you have more information or a correction on something mentioned in this chapter, please get in touch through our website. We aim to ensure that all information provided is accurate and up to date, and this remains a top priority. If you want to support the show, receive early access, and have more of a say in what we do, then become a patron by clicking the link in our show notes. For these chapters in video format, simply search Urban Legends Folklore on YouTube. Follow us on TikTok, Instagram, and Threads, and join our Facebook group by searching Urban Legends Folklore.